Good morning, everyone. Welcome to our service this morning. For those of you who are tuning in for the first time, my name is Nick Taves. I'm one of the pastors here, and I have the immense privilege today of sharing with you some of the things that I've learned and discovered and been taught about faith, Jesus, and community. We are approaching Easter, which is the time when we remember a monumental moment in history, Jesus' death on a cross and his resurrection from the grave. This isn't just a momentous moment for us. This is something that has affected history, has affected all cultures. Now, looking back and celebrating or remembering is a concept we're all fairly familiar with. We do it every year for our birthdays, whether it's, or we do it as a nation, like on July 4th, where we celebrate Canada's formation of Confederacy and the movement towards independence. We get this idea. We get the idea of celebrating, of marking a day so that we look back and we think about something important. However, usually in our society, we have happy occasions and we have sad occasions. We have moments of grief that we look back on. November 11th is one of those where we look back and we think about the sacrifice and significance of war. We don't usually put these two ideas together. We keep them separate. That's not how life works. You don't just experience happiness all day one day and then sadness all day the next. It's a flux. We go up and down. These are two emotions that go together. But it sure is easier when we keep them separate. Easter does not allow us to do that. Easter is a time when we bring together grief and joy. It's celebration and it's mourning. That means it's a bit complicated to celebrate. Now, I'm sure you've all been to Easter services where you felt like they were too happy clappy or too down and grief filled. That's because it's tough. It's tough to get the right balance. Instead of looking for a service that's going to get the balance the way we want it, I'm going to ask us to prepare ourselves to experience the depth and range of emotion. We're going to do a little bit of stretching then to prepare ourselves for Easter. Now, when you go for a run, you stretch out your muscles and you do the exercises that get you ready to run. Not because you can't run without doing those things, but because when you stretch, you maintain your range of motion. Now, recently I hurt my back, and so this has been a very pertinent experience for me where I'm trying to learn how to bend again. I didn't realize that people hit a point sometimes where they just can't bend anymore. And now I have to stretch. I have to kind of regain that range of motion. And now we are going to prepare ourselves for Easter over the next 2 weeks. Winston set a good example for us last week. Justin will carry the torch next week. And instead of increasing our range of motion, we're going to be increasing our range of emotion. We're going to try and stretch out our feelings so that we can be ready for this. Now, for today, we're going to look at the Easter journey from Paul's perspective in Romans chapter 5, verses 6 and 11. And it's because Paul's letters shed light on how the earliest church understood Easter. So if we want to stretch our emotions, let's go back and look at the church. Let's go back and look at the earliest church and see how they thought and approached Easter. Now, you probably knew this, but the oldest sources in the New Testament are the letters. the letters that the apostles wrote. And Paul in particular appears to be, the letters that he wrote appear to be the oldest ones we have. That means they came first. Now, we don't put them first in the New Testament. And the reason we don't do this is because, for one, practically, that's not easy to do. We need to understand the story before we look to the letters. And we also put the Gospels first because they reflect firsthand knowledge of Jesus. Paul didn't know Jesus, directly, the same way the apostles did. But keep in mind, please, that these letters reveal to us what people thought of Jesus after his death and resurrection. Now, the correspondence between the letters and the Gospels is amazing. This is something that I feel passionate about and I love pointing out. And if we could fill the whole sermon with that, that'd be great. I would do that immediately. We don't have time for that. But I just want to say one little thing. The consistency we have between what Paul says in our passage today and what we see in the Gospels is amazing. Two different authors, two different times, three different time periods, and all of it converges together to say the same message. If you're not feeling the significance of that, go and watch the X-Men movies that people made over the last 20 years and tell me that you're not impressed that in the ancient world, 2,000 years ago, people could tell a more coherent and consistent story than people can today. It's remarkable. Now let's get back on track. We're going to delve into Romans because it's going to set us up to look at Easter and comprehend its importance. It's going to help us understand Jesus' death and resurrection. And it's not just a personal significance, but it's a cosmic one. So join me in reading Romans 5, 6 to 11. Starting at verse 6, Paul says, "You see, at just the right time, when we were still powerless, Christ died for the ungodly." In that one sentence, Paul has given us three distinct ideas, and they are major claims. First, Paul tells us that this all happened at the right time. What does that mean? What's the right time? What's the wrong time? Many have speculated, and there are passages in the New Testament that also talk about God's timing, and they all point toward Jesus coming at the culmination point in history. But could it be that the timing isn't about timing on a clock? It's about Jesus himself. Jesus is the right time. Jesus is the culmination of history. Now, if this is maybe getting you thinking, that's great. If it's hurting your brain a little, don't worry. This is something well above my own pay grade. People far smarter than me have delved into this and gotten nowhere. But we'll suffice it to say that Jesus' place in history is no accident. It's not a coincidence. And we can look at this time as a pinnacle moment for all humanity. The early church saw Easter as the right time. It was the right time then, and it's the right time now. Secondly, Paul makes it clear that he sees that humanity is stuck in a place of powerlessness. Now, you might hear this phrase and take it for granted. Of course, people are powerless. Of course, there's sin in the world. Of course, there's something wrong. But the ancient world did not take what Paul says for granted. The ancient world saw the problem differently. And, fun fact, basically, everybody in the ancient world agreed that the problem was that the problem was related to piety. From Egypt to Babylon to Rome, everybody thought the fate of the world rested on piety. Now, for those who don't know, piety isn't about being nice. It's not about being upright. It's about being in right relationship, about knowing how to behave properly and in consistency with God or gods. Now, you look back on Rome and our perspective on Rome, why were they successful? They were organized. They had formations, an army that were super effective, and they were able to create roads and things like this. These are the reasons that we see Rome as being successful. You look back at Roman authors, you know why they thought they were successful? Because they were the most pious nation. They had dominance in the world because they knew how to treat the gods and gain their favor and power. They were pious. Why did Rome fall? You know what they said? It's because they lost their piety. They lost their worship of the gods and their connection to the gods, and so the gods had abandoned them. Piety was the source of lack of piety was the source of the world's problems. Now, Jewish people sort of believe this too, and by the New Testament time, you can see that there's a bunch of different factions, and they all disagree with each other based on how they think being pious is, how you act and behave according to the law. That's a piety. Now, Jesus challenged this idea. Jesus challenged this idea that following the law was the way of gaining God's favor, of being a part of the salvation plan. Jesus instead placed piety behind faith, behind trust. Trusting God then is the solution to the problem. And as long as you think that effort and power will rescue you from the pain and withering of life, you'll fail, you'll fall, or your success will be temporary. Did Egypt's piety save it from Babylon? No. Did the Roman piety survive the Gaul invasion? No. So when you hear Paul's words, know this, that they're unique. They stand out. And they should stand out to us. Easter, then, for the earliest church, was connected to this belief that the people, that we are powerless. Powerless to rise to the piety that we think that we need. We're both morally incapable, but we also lack the capacity to change our state of things. Now, we've all been here. We've all experienced being powerless, unable to act, either because of our own willingness to change or because somebody else has dominated us or put us in a position where we can't do anything else other than what they want. If you feel powerless or are in a place in your life where you see no way out, then Easter is for you. And then you're ready for Easter. Because Easter is for the range. It's for the range of emotions and places that we're in. It's a time of pain. It's a time of sorrow. It's a time of joy. And it's a time of freedom. It's a time for those who feel trapped in chains. And it's a time for those who have experienced the unexpected and unwarranted joy and freedom that comes with following Christ. Paul continues, and even further than just stating what the problem is, he offers us what the solution is. Jesus steps in and dies. Here we thought the solution to the problem, all the problems in the world, was just to identify the problem and fix it. try harder and demand more. But Jesus shows us that salvation is brought into the world through the very tool we hate, the very thing that we avoid talking about, the very thing that we're afraid of. It's death. The first curse. In my own life, when I have had people pass away, when I've seen people go through the dying process, and when I've seen people who are dead, I've always felt an intense hatred for death. I hate it. That the people I love and cherish, that the people that I think deserve better and more, must one day die, experience the pain of having our bodies fail and fall apart. It feels so wrong. Paul knew this, and he knew that we should all expect death to be done away with. But the Bible informs us that death is the punishment for sin. It's the result of this painful process that we've done of missing the mark. But the remarkable thing is that Jesus takes that punishment, takes that curse, and turns it into a path for salvation. That the fixing of the problems in the world lies in death. This is not a sensible plan. It's not a good idea. The ancient world never would have thought this. This is beyond their realm of imagination. And even today, I think we still feel like, well, you know, trying harder and doing more seem pretty practical solutions. Maybe we should just stick with that. But that's not Jesus. Jesus isn't working with common sense. He's working with a deeper knowledge. The knowledge only a creator could possibly know. Paul furthers this point by saying, very rarely will anyone die for a righteous person, though for a good person, someone might possibly dare to die. But God demonstrates his own love for us in this. While we were still sinners, Christ died for us. This doesn't follow common sense. Christ dying for sinners, sometimes we take that idea of sinners and we soften it. Oh, you know, I did something wrong. I'm a sinner. No. Sinner is another word for enemy. While we were still God's enemies, people who actively oppose God, actively worked against, set ourselves against, that's when Christ died for us. In this example, Paul lays out two kinds of people, the righteous and the good. It's not clear what the distinction is between the two, but it does appear that Paul might be saying something like the righteous, that's people who are technically right. You know, if somebody's technically right, would you die for them? Well, probably not. Usually when we say that somebody's technically right, we're really trying to say that they're actually wrong. But dying for a good person, that's someone that you would see as being like kind, somebody with good character, someone that maybe you look up to. And in that sense, yeah, you might die for them. But common sense tells us that dying isn't the way to change things. The dying isn't what we want to do. But Jesus didn't die for either the righteous person or the good person. Jesus didn't die for one who was technically right, and Jesus didn't die for people who were really, really good. Jesus died for his enemies. That doesn't make sense. It doesn't make sense to die for enemies because enemies, by definition, have no worth. You look at any movie these days with villains and enemies, and you know before the movie even starts that that villain is going to die. That's the pattern that we have in our culture. That's what we expect. And that makes sense. But that's not Jesus's way. Sue, at the beginning of the service, took time to think of an enemy. It's kind of hard sometimes. It's a really strong word. Enemy is really strong. But take a moment right now and think of an enemy. Picture them in their head, in your head. And picture them at their worst. Picture them as people in opposition to God or in opposition to you. And that's who Jesus died for. That's a tough pill to swallow. It's a tough pill to swallow when you don't think of yourself as an enemy as well. I worked at a mill for a summer, and I had a guy there that I considered my enemy. He would constantly harp on me. He would make my life miserable, and he would make my work tougher. Every opportunity he got, he tried to put a roadblock in what I was doing, or he tried to say bad things about me. And I hated this guy. This guy was an enemy. And when I read this passage, I think of him. I think of him as somebody who Jesus died for. And we're called to die for these people as well. We're called to die towards what we want, to our priorities, to our rights, to our desires, and ask to lay those down so that we can call others into this family. To take up your cross, to borrow a phrase from the Gospels, is meant to follow the pattern that Jesus set. And that's a pattern that looks at enemies and doesn't say, you have no value, or that I should get rid of you. Instead, it's a call to embrace, a call to bring them in, and a call to change enemies into family. Paul continues, since we've now been justified by his blood, how much more shall we be saved from God's wrath through him? For if while we were God's enemies, we were reconciled to him through the death of his son, how much more, having been reconciled, shall we be saved through his life? Not only is this so, but we also boast in God through our Lord Jesus Christ, through whom we have now received reconciliation. Whew. You can see the excitement bouncing off of the pages. Paul here is stringing together so many things, and you can see it's bubbling up faster and faster. Now we have a piety that is grounded in not our own efforts, not in our own results, but in Jesus' work, in Jesus' effort, in what Jesus accomplished. We have a word for this. It's justification. It's a really, you know, technical word in Christian theology, but it carries this idea of being on the right side of things. In the Old Testament, Israel was justified, not because they were better than anyone else or they did everything right, but because they followed Yahweh, God alone, and not other gods. Justification is a word we use in theology, this kind of picture of a law court. In court, you have two sides, the accusers and the defenders. So for Israel, in the ancient world, the accuser said, there are multiple gods, you should serve multiple gods. We should just kind of combine of all of our gods together. That's the right way to do things. And Israel said, no, we have one God. Who's justified in this argument? It would be Israel. Justification, then, a really good and important idea. And where common sense tells us that doing the right thing puts you on the justified side, Jesus justifies us and just takes us and puts us on the right side through his sacrifice. We're justified because we put our trust in him. Instead of being God's enemies, we're brought into God's family. We often talk about how we are a church that is characterized by reconciliation. That's a really core identity piece for our church. And that's a really good thing. So don't get me wrong. It's really good. But the early church, and in this passage in particular, Paul didn't just see themselves as bringing reconciliation. Reconciliation brings you back to zero. So if you steal $20 from your friend, your relationship is broken, you need to restore this, you need to reconcile. Part of that reconciliation is you bring the $20 back and you give it to them. You've been reconciled. You're back at zero. There's no debt to be paid between the two of you. Jesus doesn't just bring us back to zero. That's not what Jesus just did. He did that. But Jesus also rises again. Jesus dies on the cross, brings us back to zero, reconciles us to God, and then does more. He rises again. In the Old Testament, Israel killed animals to reconcile themselves with God. They sacrificed animals. Those animals did not come back to life. But Jesus did. Not only are we reconciled, but we have been given an opportunity for life in a way that's unheard of. Saved from death. Yes, that's our Good Friday message. You see Jesus die on the cross sacrificially for us. And then Easter comes and he rises again to new life. Reconciled and given more. The church is supposed to be a place about life, being alive, experiencing the flourishing that we're meant to embody as God's creation. The early church didn't take care of people just because they thought it might lead to a better society one day. They did this because their God was all about bringing life. The early church didn't pick up discarded children and people from the road and bring them in and care for them because they thought that that was a good idea. They did it because they knew that God was all about life, not throwing people away, not just death. What we do here at church is about life. It's about setting aside our fear of death because we know that death doesn't get the final word. We know that Jesus died and rose again. And we know that this idea of perfect piety isn't going to lead anywhere. What we are about is trust. And a trust that's so significant that you can even look at enemies as people. A trust that's so significant that even if you died because you love your enemies, that's worth it. In fact, you're following exactly the example that Jesus set. That is something to boast about. We don't really like boasting. Boasting is never characterized as a good thing, basically anywhere. Even when you boast about your kids, it doesn't come off well, so don't do it. Which I just did at the beginning of the service. Oops. Now, we are called to boast. We're called to boast and celebrate Easter. Friends, families, and maybe even enemies, the church is a place that boasts in Jesus. And that's good news. But we can't boast if we don't have an audience. We're not just called to boast within our inner circle of church people. This is a boasting that's supposed to go out. We're supposed to boast about Jesus' death and resurrection. That's a tough call. It's hard to find that line between boasting about ourselves and maybe boasting about God. Our faith and ourselves are really intermeshed. But don't let go of it. We have something. I've just spent this entire sermon saying that we have something unique, unexpected, and abundantly good. Let's offer it to others. Let's boast about this church, about this faith that we have. Because our world is a place that needs it. Our world is a place that crushes itself into the grinding temptation of chasing after piety. No matter what, how you define that piety, whether it's if I can just be culturally sensitive enough, then I'll get things right. Or if I can just change the structures of society enough, then it will be a place that's good and worthwhile. That is a tough battle. It takes a lot of grit. Some people spend their whole lives doing it and come out the other end happy that they did it. But I think for most of us, that's too tough. We're not an Achilles. We're not a hero. We're just normal people. And normal people can tap into a power that is beyond anything else. So put your trust in Jesus. That's the message that we're about. That's the core of who we are. And I pray that that becomes more and more true for you. And I pray, too, that it's something that we find a way to share more and more. I invite you to bow with me and pray. Father, we thank you so much. We ask that you give us the courage to put a radical amount of trust in you. Easter is a time where we're reminded of what you've done, what you've accomplished, and how that should change our lives. I pray that we would continue to expand our emotions into this season so that we can feel and understand the depth of your sacrifice and your rise. And Lord, even though we fail and we miss and we struggle against our feelings of powerlessness, I pray that we would continue to feel the encouragement and hope that you are a God who takes care of us. Thank you, Lord. Amen.